Good morning, good afternoon and evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Outsource Talks. I'm Jamie Liddell, Outsource Editor-in-Chief, and we are coming for a special Outsource Talks today, live from the SIG Summit in Carlsbad, California. So it's pretty early for us. Thank you very much for all of you here who are joining us. Thank you also for everyone on the other side of the world for joining us. We have an absolutely fantastic panel for you today. Also, thank you very much for your questions. I'm going to be putting those through to our panelists. For those of you who haven't submitted questions, of course, through the course of the webinar, you can do so using the chat or question function. It's in the bottom or top right of your WebEx panel, depending on what operating system you're using. If you're dialing in, of course, no questions, but you may well have sent them in through email before. Thank you very much for that. If you are listening to this and you want to tweet, then hashtag SIGFall16, I believe, SIGFall16. So we'll look forward to some of those. My panel today are three of the finest gentlemen you will ever meet. Ed Hansen is a lawyer and a longtime friend of SIG, also an occasional contributor to Outsource. Looking forward to those questions coming in. Gary Malotra, a man I've only just met, but has a reputation par none in the industry, and Tom Mead, another fantastic contributor to Outsource. Hopefully you guys have been reading his articles on sales operations over the last couple of months. So three absolutely fantastic guys. We're really, really looking forward to finding out a little bit more about some of their takes on some of the stuff that's going on here at SIG today, and obviously in the broader industry. We do want this to be an interactive session as usual. Those of you who are regular Outsource Talks listeners will know that we like to get questions coming in through. We will put them through in the Q&A session in the second half of the show. So thank you very much for joining us, guys. Moving straight through into our first one-to-one is Ed Hansen. I'm not gonna read through the bio on the screen. You can see Ed's email at the bottom. So any questions that you don't get answered during this session, feel free to pester you, I guess, Ed. Welcome, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling good.
Excellent. It's a little bit early for this kind of thing, but thank you.
On East Coast time, so
I'm fine. Okay, come to London time and you'll need the coffee, I think. I was going to ask you the thing about being guilty of the murders that you sent me, but instead we're going to have to go straight through to RPA. With RPA increasingly dominating the landscape, it certainly was dominating some of the questions yesterday at Day One of SIG. And obviously the ongoing digital revolution. How do you see the contract changing? How do you see the role that the contract plays going forward? Obviously, it's something that you've been spending a lot of your career on. Where is that going?
Well, I think the first thing that you need to realize is that I don't have a 10-year horizon when I think about these things, meaning that I can't sit here and think about people losing their hands and they're going to be doing things with just their minds and robots are going to be taking over everything else. That's just not the way that I'm thinking about things. The way that I think about things is in basically 3 to 5 year windows. What I see is being the current sort of problem that we have to solve to be able to prepare you for what's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years. And the problem is anytime that you get into a contract or outsourcing, and when you're talking about RPA, I'm going to talk about it in the context of outsourcing, because that's where you have the economic rents involved that keep you from being able to adapt and adopt to technologies that are coming down the road. So I think there are a couple of things that we have to think about. First of all, a lot of this isn't as new as marketing hype is trying to make it out to be, in the sense that you have automation. You've had automation in these processes for years and years and years. I mean, the reason that people went to SAP and to ERP systems was to get some automation into the processes that they were doing manually. So it's not like we haven't seen automation before. The big game changer is cognitive automation. And you're not seeing as much cognitive automation as people would make you think you are. In a sense that, you know, when you're seeing BPOs, you're seeing automation and cognitive automation lumped in together. And the idea, of course, is that over time, cognitive automation will start to take over some of the functions that people are doing, which leaves you with a couple of questions. One is, how do you write a contract that basically allows you to adopt to those technologies without blowing the entire business model around what you did when you were contracting in 2016? And that, by the way, is not as much a contract problem as is a fee schedule problem. And I think what a lot of people miss when you talk about outsourcing is a lot of talk about the MSA, and lawyers tend to focus on the MSA. But the truth is, a lot of the problems that you have to solve through the fee schedule. So first thing I would say is pay attention to the fee schedule, because you need to have ways of adapting to new technology. There will be clauses that will allow, for example, if you're looking for innovation, you have to make it worth the while of the vendor to innovate, right? So it has to be some sort of gain sharing mechanisms. To the extent that they're doing that across the industry, you're not going to do gain sharing the same way that you've traditionally done gain sharing, because a lot of the gain sharing now is going to be spread out. So that's one thing to think about. With cognitive automation, one of the problems that you could face is one of the sort of economic rents that are involved in not being able to exit the contract, right? One of the problems that you have with outsourcing, and you've always had with outsourcing, is that there's a transition involved. And once you have a transition, you basically completely increase the level of risk that's involved with moving. So now you're involved in something where economics don't work the way that they should, because you have economic barriers that don't allow you to basically move in and out. So you have these you know, barriers to entry and exit. In the past, that was a money problem, right? Because if you decided that you were going to take the risk, that was your decision, and that was a question of making the vendor whole. Now we're going to have a knowledge-based problem, because it's not clear yet, I don't think, how the knowledge that cognitive automation is gaining that impacts the environment that's working is going to be able to be transferred between, you know, technologies that may be the other kind of automation or cognitive automation that you're looking to go through. So, like right now, we think about this, when you get into a BPO, you would set up a kind of university within the BPO provider role of knowledge sets. Well, that works well when you're looking at language. The question is, what do you do when you start looking at, when you're looking at that kind of knowledge as proprietary technology in addition to being the knowledge that's in there? And I think that's one of the interesting questions that we're going to have. And we have to address it.
Okay, there is already enough there for an entire webinar, so good one. Thank you. I've got about 17 questions I could leap on. Hold that thought, please, Ed. We're going to move on to our next panelist and then bring that in. So, Gary, thank you very much for joining us today. Again, I'm not going to read the bio that's on the screen. You guys are who've come in through Webex can see that, and also the email address at the bottom. Gary, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to SIG. I think you said it's your 10th one, isn't it?
Yes, so a long time. Thank you.
Certainly no stranger to the environment. We're going to come on to some of the topics that have been brought up in the summit a little bit later on. First, let's kind of take a high-level view. What are the trends that you're seeing going on in procurement today?
That's a great question. I think what we're seeing is that the chief procurement officers really are trying to create a competitive advantage for their companies. And, you know, they've had a good run at savings in the past 8, 9, 10 years or so, and savings have been easier to get by because of all of the deflation and the global uncertainty. They're really now trying to focus on new levers of value creation, right? Whether it is trying to lead outsourcing of outsourcing and managing those relationships, whether it is managing more services spend, you know, helping the C-suite take care of enterprise risk and supply risk, which is a hot topic, whether it's, you know, providing the organization more agility, you know, in terms of the procurement infrastructure and helping the whole innovation agenda through supplier-led innovation. So they're trying to really be more relevant to the C-suite by really trying to lead these new areas of value.
I'm just going to pick up on a little bit of that. There's been a lot of conversation here already about the kind of longer-term value of the CPO. Because in a lot of organizations, procurement is becoming a lot more of a diffuse kind of, you know, function. So do you feel that the quest for the CPO to have C-suite value that we've been talking about for years is in fact maybe becoming increasingly obsolete now in some organizations because procurement as a function is being put across so many different other functions?
Well, I think that's certainly true for, I mean, some of the traditional sources of value that are associated with procurement, right? So if you could, you know, if you talk about placing purchase orders, for example, I mean, I think it's easy to conceive someone in the engineering group saying, well, gee, I can, you know, place a purchase order with a supplier, right? Almost everybody feels like they're a great source or a negotiator, whether they are or not. Almost everybody feels that they can do a contract, right? Everybody's done some bit of contracts, right? So I think those are sort of what I call sort of the old sources of value where either procurement has added so much value that people kind of know what to expect, there's methodology and templates and processes that, you know, even the business stakeholders are getting used to because they work with procurement. Let's not forget that 90% of Fortune 1000 companies do have CPOs now, right? And so therefore, you know, CPOs have to remain relevant. It cannot be by trying to just over-rotate on the stuff that they've already delivered on and that the stakeholders have come to expect. It's really going to have to follow the new priorities of the organization, whether it's the sweet seat saying, like, how do I, for example, if you're a bank, respond to the OCC guidelines, or, you know, around supply risk management, right? Or, and what does Brexit mean? And how does that impact my supply chain? Okay, I was very happy with the Philippines and India as outsourced locations, right? But then now there's so much politically changing equation in the Philippines. They're moving away from the U.S. Mm-hmm. There were, last month or so, there were a lot of fires in Bangalore, right, because of the protests against the water sharing, right? So I think it's really helping the organization get ahead on newer topics is where I think CPOs will get the relevance.
It almost sounds facile, but there's a good degree of complexity creeping into all areas of sourcing. Let's look at one of those complex spend. How can you elaborate a little bit more on maybe how procurement leaders are looking to manage complex spend and complex service acquisition?
Sure. And so I think if you look at outsourcing, I'm glad you started with Ed on that topic, right? I mean, I think it just takes so much, it's a five-year arrangement. There's so much more complexity from, you know, standpoint of new talent and discipline, right? So you're going to now start managing a relationship with the provider as opposed to an arm's length, hey, I did a deal with you and the contracts and the system, right? So you need procurement talent who knows how to manage relationships. You need to manage a lot more complex contractual relationships. You got to start tracking supply obligations and deliverables and commitments, and you know how the supplier is actually meeting those. You got to get into a whole new level of SLA tracking, not just rely on the supplier to say, you know, here's a spreadsheet with the SLA, but actually start looking at data from your ticketing and transaction system and computing that and then doing your arts and looks and deducting the penalties, right? So it's just a lot higher level of complexity. And I think, you know, that's not very well understood in you know, either vendor management or IT or other parts or finance and accounting or HR or all the functions that do typically outsource. So I think procurement has an opportunity to come in with a process, come in with these management capabilities, come in with source-to-pay technology that does address these areas and actually lead the change there and deliver more sustaining value.
Great. Once again, there's enough material there for for a whole webinar. Hold that thought again, Gary. We will be coming back to that when we move to Q&A. Once again, guys, for those of you who have come in through WebEx, please do send your questions through using the chat or Q&A function. Our third, but by no means least, panelist today is Tom Mead. Tom, welcome.
Hey.
Thank you very, very much for joining us. Hopefully those listeners who are regular readers of Outsource will have checked out Tom's articles over the last couple of months. They've been fantastic. Tom, you have been in this business for quite a while. Tell us a little bit about how you've seen the landscape change over the last, say, quarter century or so that you've been in the business.
Yeah, actually, you're right. It's been a little more than a quarter century. I'd say that the more things change, the more they remain the same. The pieces and parts are changing along the way, but the underlying process of how we go about doing contracting and selling and such remains the same. Gary's points all right on target, and I agree that the agreements in and of themselves can have kind of the broad brush strokes, but the devil's in the details. So the fee structures, for example, need to be aligned with giving the organization the flexibility to do what it needs to do. And one of the problems that I've seen over the years, and it continues for 25 years, it probably was going for 100 years before I ever got involved, is the concept of contract leveling, where the procurement department will put out an RFP, RFX of some kind, and ask everyone to bid to the same requirements. Basically, we have presupposed the correct solution. Everyone needs to bid to these requirements. And then from that, we will determine which ones we're going to go forward with a 20% reduction being sort of the norm. The problem is when you do that, you strip out their ability to bring you the innovation. Now, what I would suggest is a better approach to get the results, but it may not be the better approach in terms of the RFP process and managing it, just because it becomes more complex, is instead of defining the process and saying, you know, bid to our process, tell us, if this is what we're trying to accomplish, this is where we're trying to get to, how would you get us there with a 20% reduction assumed? So don't predefine the process. You're outsourcing
the process to get a defined result. And if you keep the focus there, then you're going to get the solution that you're looking for that provides that flexibility. Otherwise, you'll wind up into, you know, these longer-term 5 or 10-year contracts where you have a pricing mechanism that is structured to achieve one thing, but then the business changes direction. There was a bank that we were doing business with that had that problem. They got into a contract, and 5 or 6 years into it, they realized, we want to go in a different direction. So, but the pricing mechanism of how the vendor was being compensated was contradictory to how they wanted to change the strategy of the company. But if the structure had been put in place to allow for that flexibility and not just say, well, you know, we have a contract, this is how it's going to be, and this is what we need you to do, but, oh, by the way, now we have changed direction. Well, the old rules don't apply anymore. So by keeping the supplier in line with your strategy, and that requires a higher degree of collaboration as well, that, you know, isn't necessarily something you're going to get during the RFP process, although you will learn a lot about how a company behaves because a company's culture will be identified during that RFP process, and you're going to realize beyond price, is this someone who I can feel a strategic relationship with? Will they be an integral partner, or are they just going to be a high-value supplier to us? So for the supplier side of it, you know, they need to be doing a better job of qualifying their opportunities and not bidding on everything that moves. And for the sellers, or for the buyers, they need to be looking at it more. If you want a partnership, then you need to approach it as a partner type relationship. If you're really just looking for a low cost, commoditized approach to do something that's a, you know, high volume, low cost transaction type scenario, then approach it with that direction. But to approach it, a high value scenario with a low cost approach, you're not going to get the good result.
So one of the things that that came up quite a bit in the session I shared yesterday was innovation and how to achieve, and you brought that up quite early just then.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see in the, you know, in the agreements that you've been part of recently, or what you've been discussing with your peers over the last couple of years, do you see innovation being achieved through outsourcing, or in fact is it a bit of a limiter?
Well, going back in history, if you will, back to the 80s and 90s, when BPO and outsourcing really sort of came into being in a prominent way, when the term outsourcing was actually first coined in the late 80s, there were a lot of contracts that were being done that did bring that level of innovation that people were seeking. There were also the commodity contracts where you're just processing transactions, but there were several very well-known contracts back then that did bring a high degree of valuation and showed that degree of synergy between the supplier and the buyer. A great example of that would have been the City of Chicago Parking Authority back in the early 90s, which originally put out an RFP to purchase mainframes and wound up buying a services agreement from EDS that EDS didn't charge them anything for the service. They only took 10% of the increase in revenue collection. So if revenue collection didn't increase, EDS would have collected nothing. But they reinvented the entire process, and as it turned out, it yielded about $440 million in revenue for EDS. And to her credit, Susan Rice, who was the Deputy Director of Revenue for the City of Chicago at the time, she was at a conference one time and was asked, so knowing what you know now and seeing how much you paid EDS, if you had to do over again, would you do it differently? And she said, absolutely not. I'm happy to pay them because every time I pay them a dollar, I'm getting nine. So the more I pay them, it's the more we get. This is it's a great arrangement. I just hope we can find more ways to work with them to do other things in other parts of the organization. So what happened, though, was when we hit the year 2000 mark and when a lot of the stuff got offshore, both ITO and BPO, then the focus really became driven down to, wow, we can do this really cheaply. And innovation, I think, got assumed that, well, we've been getting innovation all these years. Now we just can get it for less. And that turned out not to be the case. You know, you buy cheap, you get cheap. So they got the transactional aspect, and innovation kind of fell off the way. The suppliers, to their credit, and I've worked for several of them, they tried to introduce innovation along the way. But it was sort of like, yeah, that's nice, but you know, we just don't need the low cost. And admittedly, the CEOs, the COOs are driving a lot of those procurement heads, just get me the low cost, because our numbers are looking good. The result was the innovation got stripped out, and now people are kind of saying, you know, low cost is good, but we need that innovation back. We need to be able to upstart our competition. So now with things like RPA and such, it's causing companies to take a step back to rethink the process and redefine the process and then look for someone that can help us innovate going forward. And that's why I think you're seeing some of the repatriation that's going on, is because people are looking at it and saying it's really not just about cost. Cost on the front end maybe is one component, but if you look at it, if I can save, you know, 0.2% on my operating budget, or let's say that's $20 million. But if I can increase my revenue by 5%, that's a much bigger number. So let's put the focus out there and not strip away entirely the cost savings component. You still got to operate lean, but you have to be looking for ways to improve the business. And RPA presents that opportunity to do that by redefining how the work gets done.
Again, another webinar full of material there. Thank you very much, Tom. I'm going to bring the other two panelists back in at this point. Once again, guys, please do send your questions through to us using the WebEx function. Gary, you were nodding a lot through Tom's little bit there. I guess you're agreeing with a lot of that. What would you like to pick up on?
Yeah, no, I think Tom is absolutely right in terms of, you know, I think I've been in the outsourcing side as well, where you get 10 days to respond to an RFP, and you get one session with the stakeholders and the business, and then you're expected to innovate, you know, as a provider and innovate in process and technology and your business model, and it's really hard.
And you never spoke with them before.
Right, exactly. And I think what I was thinking as you were saying that, Tom, is really back to, you know, my point on procurement adding the strategic value is really procurement needs to sort of spend time with look at the suppliers as partners and strategic, and spend the time up front knowing the capability of, you know, a technology provider or an outsource provider, and seeing what they're capable of, what their niche in terms of, you know, industry and process, and what ticks them, and what's their DNA, and I think that's what will give procurement even more confidence to have go back to the C-suite and say, look, let's not invite 50 people to the party, let's talk to these three, because given our industry and our niche and our process and our, you know, appetite for technology or RPA, these seems to be the right vendor providers. And I think the executive look for that insight. But I think if procurement just looks at procurement the old way of, you know, here's an, you know, 300 line RFP and I'm going to invite 50 people, then they're going to miss the opportunity to add value.
And you're bringing up a great point too, which is how procurement goes about their job now has changed through the years as a result of things like social media. You know, that didn't exist 20 years ago in any form that anyone would recognize. And when you look at surveys that have been done, and I'll probably do one for my column in the coming months, but of how procurement wants to be engaged by the supplier, how they want to buy, and how they want to learn about supplier capabilities. Learning from the salesperson typically ranks like number 7 on the list. It's going to conferences like the Sourcing Interest Group, where we are now, and learning from their peers what they're doing. And through other informal sources like social media would be another way. You know, reading a Gartner report and Forrester report, you know, that'll rank like typically number 4 or 5. It's good, but they recognize there's a little bit of a sell job going on typically in those scenarios as well. So, to your point, by doing the upfront homework, by networking in a way that you can do that now that you couldn't have done it as well before, utilizing things like social media, you're then able to make a more informed initial decision as to who do you want to invite to the party.
I mean, one of the other things that comes with this, I think there's going to be a realization that I hope is going to happen in the next year or two. And that is that people need to realize that the contracts that they're writing for these kinds of deals, when I talk about the contracts, I'm really talking about the deal. I'm not getting really into the legalese of all this. I'm really thinking about the overall, you know, the overall ecosystem. With this kind of work, the contract is always incomplete. Okay, there's no such thing as a complete outsourcing contract. It's always going to be incomplete. And what that means is that the underlying economics of the ecosystem need to work, because you can't always impose your will through a contract in this environment. In other words, the thing that always makes me laugh is when people talk about contracting innovation. And to a lot of people, that means putting a clause in a contract that says that you're going to innovate. And that's just not the way it works. What has to happen is the contract needs to set up the ecosystem that allows innovation to happen. And that starts way back at the procurement process. And in fact, it's funny, in 2007, Farce did a case study on the contracting process that I used. And the whole thing was completely built around the idea of high-performing teams. Right? It was never built around the idea of trying to get a particular term or a particular condition. It's always about how you set up a contract that allows high-performing teams to develop, and how do you use that process as a way of testing that. And I think that lines up with a lot of what you're saying now in terms of the way that innovation works its way back into these BPOs.
Well, there was a study that was done by what was then Equiterra, now KPMG, going back about 5 years, and found that the single most important determining factor in the success of successful contracts was the governance component, where you're creating the team between the supplier and the buyer. And again, not getting into that we-they kind of scenario. And even in the contracting process, going back to my earlier point, if you tell them this is where we're trying to go and this is kind of sort of how we're trying to get there, what can you do to facilitate that process? You're giving them that peek under the tent that enables them to bring their creative capabilities to the table. But when you don't let them peek under the tent, and you keep the door completely shut, then they're bidding in the dark, and they'll never be able to get to the innovation component that you're talking about, where you have to have the collaboration with them in the process.
And just to be clear on that whole thing with the governance, what tends to happen is lots of times the entire governance part of the arrangement is left to the end.
Yes.
And you tend to use your advisor's last governance schedule. So you end up with meetings that are going to happen once a year. You have other meetings that are going to happen quarterly. You have operational meetings that happen. But you never really get into how you work during the process to come to contract and how you solve problems together, who actually pick up the phone and called and how that worked. And, working that into your governance model is actually very important. In a lot of ways, the governance exhibit on an outsourcing contract is almost useless.
Well, that's a great point, too, because when you look at governance, you need to think about this. If this was your own team, if you had this function internally, would you not allow them to be in the room for the discussion? The answer is, of course not. They're part of our company. Well, you have to look at the supplier in the same way. There's a lot of virtual companies out there that have a mall type effect of people that are supporting them. You have to bring them together. And when you don't approach that on the front end of understanding that this is going to change how we engage with the supplier, or at least in this particular one supplier, then you're probably destined to fail.
Yeah, and I think, Tom, I'd like to pick up on that. I mean, I think one of the big trends we're seeing in with our clients, because obviously they use the sourcing and contract technology, is what they call concurrent procurement, where you've got five work streams going on at the same time, right? So you've got a brainstorm innovation session, like Tom, your point, what should the ideal solution look like? At the same time, there's a parallel contracting SOW work stream. At the same time, there is the sourcing and the price discussion, while at the same time there is basically a discussion on governance and how this would look like at the end of the contract, right? And I think that's, again, if you think of that compared to traditional procurement, where you did the sourcing and then you did the contracting, then to your point, governance would be an afterthought. There's an awful lot of work in coordination, and I think that's, again, an opportunity for sourcing and procurement to sort of lead that change and then basically make sure that happens and add value in that way that perhaps a lot of procurement organizations are not doing today.
Question come through on a point towards you, Ed, to start off with, but of course you guys can come in on this as well. Are there enough RPA contracts out there to tell you what an RPA contract looks like?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I know that I've seen a couple, and I know that our firm is in a few, and that we have views on this. I'm not sure that we have an industry, if you look at the way these evolve over time, like when you look at the MSA of an outsourcing agreement, a lot of times the MSA terms are basically market-driven, right? So if you look at limitations of liability clauses, for example, that you get today, they don't look the same as limitation of liability clauses that you got 10 years ago, and that's largely driven by the market. I think right now we're forming the market in how we do these, and I think what my advice would be, and what my advice is to look at what you need to get, right, and look at how and look at the fundamentals. How do you change your price when the technology changes? How do you accumulate knowledge and be able to take it out? How do you exit the contract? How do you make sure that you're not paying for other people's innovation that you're not going to get to use? And then work it into the RFP and work it early enough so that you're having the discussion before you get to contract. Because once you get to contract, it's too late for this.
Yes. Guys, anyone want to pick up on that? We do have another couple of questions, but I think that's quite an interesting topic that maybe we should kind of investigate a bit more.
Yeah, I think one of the themes I'm hearing is that, you know, things are changing and will change, and RPA is certainly one example of that. And I think a lot of, you know, in addition to the trends we've been talking about, there's this whole trend of, you know, cloud computing and, you know, enterprises, you know, gravitating towards the cloud and as a service models. And I think in some sense, they typically can restrict you because, you know, you're basically taking what's out of the box by the vendor that's cheap and that's the least common denominator that, you know, many organizations will adopt, right? And I think a lot of, within the cloud computing space, there's a lot big push towards the configurable cloud, which is, you know, the cloud platform that allows you to change your process as things change, because there will be change in your process, in the way you, you know, consume things, in the way you pay for them and count and measure and settle them. So I think that's a big trend, you know, I'm seeing our clients really saying, we want the speed and the agility and the security of the cloud and the scalability, but we don't want it at the expense of, you know, losing and compromising our business process today and the flexibility to change it tomorrow.
And just to kind of piggyback on that, going back to what I had earlier said, which is if you put the contract structure in place, the RFP process that focuses on the end result first and foremost, your business goals, not on the tactical execution of the minute pieces, then you'll have the ability to change technology, to change geographies where the work might get done, to do those sorts of things, because you're not tying the contract specifically to RPA, you're not tying it specifically to cloud. Those are tools that will help you get to the goal, but the focus has to be on the goal when you get there.
Well, yeah, and what you really want to do is you want to make sure that you avoid misunderstanding during the procurement process. And when I say, by the way, that you don't want to wait until the contract, that doesn't mean I'm saying wait to get your lawyers involved, right? Because
well, they should be involved early in any way.
And the reason that I say that is that the worst thing that happens to me as a lawyer is when I get a contract to do and I haven't been involved in the procurement process and I have a vendor who has a complete misinterpretation of what the requirements are and we have a pricing model that's based on something that is not what the client intended, okay, and RPA is a place that is ripe for this, right? I did a deal relatively recently where the vendor basically just decided that they were taking into account all of these, you know, technology innovations that they were going to be able to produce in their pricing model already. We're looking at this and we're saying, you're going to be kidding me. If you actually do some of those technologies, you're going to get a 50 to 60% cost of delivery decrease. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, yeah, but that's why we're taking all this risk up front. You need to get into these kinds of discussions really early on, because if you don't, It just drives this process, and it can take a year in the contract negotiation part when you have these kinds of misaligned expectations up front. So I don't think there's a market yet in terms of a market position on these kinds of deals, but I think getting back to good practice, I think anything that was a good practice before is going to be amplified 1,000 times with robotics introduced.
Yeah, there's 2 points I'll piggyback on that. If the RFP goes out, well, go back to, if you will, an article that I did in Outsource magazine about 6 months ago. I was talking about trans-process thinking, where a lot of these processes that are done through procurement are done in silos, and you wind up with islands of excellence. But at the end of the day, when the contract then is brought together, they don't all really work together, and they may be contradictory to each other. There was a RFP I had received a few years back where the company was looking to outsource its recruiting and staffing function, mainly to be able to lower their, they thought their goal was to lower their costs of recruiting and staffing. And what they wanted to do was, instead of having 3 suppliers rebidding every year, they wanted to have 1 supplier that they would put a 3-year contract out, and the idea was that with the increased volume, we should be able to get a tiered pricing mechanism that would lower our costs. Well, that's true, except, what you're not addressing is the core reason why you have to keep hiring people, which is attrition. So if you are continuing to pour water into a bucket that's filled with holes, you're just going to have to keep pouring more and more water in, which is actually going to increase your cost. So even though your cost per unit is going to go down, if you haven't addressed the attrition problem, then you're not going to be fixing that. So what we had proposed in return was, well, let's address this again from a more holistic perspective and address the attrition. We will fix the cost per seat over a 5-year period. And then if it costs more to do that, you know, that's on our dime. And if it costs less than that, then we have a gain sharing provision in place where we're both incented. But now we're working to solve not only the front end cost of how do I hire less people, not how do I hire people cheaper, but how do I hire less people cheaper. But now we're also addressing the root cause of the problem, which was the attrition, which was not addressed anywhere in the original RFP that was put out. So it's easy to cut expense. You know, if you're a CIO, you can say, all right, we're going to eliminate these three facets of technology. Well, that's fine. It gets your department's cost down, but the corresponding impact on the increase in cost to other people who now have to live with either outdated technology or no technology goes up dramatically. And that's the whole reason technology is in place in the first place, is to eliminate cost, to eliminate people and make things more efficient. So you have to look at things, again, in a holistic perspective and take that trans-process thinking that says, well, if we reduce it in this area, am I having a corresponding negative impact to somebody else?
Mm-hmm. Gary, some thoughts on that before we move on to the next question?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with Tom. And I think I would say procurement leaders need to start with their own house, right? And so I think they need to look at not just the source to pay process holistically, but they need to look at the source to pay process with spend analytics, with services procurement, with expenses, with accounts payable, with risk management, all holistically, right? Because essentially, you know, to your example, you know, if a supplier is really not doing well on SLAs on one particular agreement, or if they haven't, you know, delayed in submitting the SSA 16 report in a delivery center, or there's a risk flag, that ought to, you know, holistically impact the new bid you're trying to give them, right? That needs to figure in some way in a risk or a governance scorecard and be part of the, you know, QBR discussion next Monday, right? And I think, again, if procurement begins to do that trans process thinking internally, the whole source to pay process, I think it will feed and bleed into the way the organization looks at these suppliers and how do you leverage the 360 of the supplier organization and their capabilities and not just focus on price.
Because if you're really doing that trans process thinking, though, when you have a bad scorecard for your SLAs, you should also be thinking not how do I get the, you know, vendor to improve the SLAs. You should be thinking about, do you have the right SLAs?
Right.
Do you are you measuring things that just don't really matter? Do you have the right process automation set up to keep your transaction costs down so that you don't have this constant interaction between the vendor and the customer that's very destructive? You know, are you doing things that's, you know, poisoning the well?
Yeah.
And are you actually getting the outcomes that you desire? Back to, you know, Tom's point, are you getting the outcomes that you require, even though the SLAs may not be getting met? Because it's very easy to actually blow your outcomes because you're pushing SLAs when what you really care about is the outcomes.
Right.
Yeah,
you're outsourcing the process to get a result.
Yeah.
So, you know, push the process away from you and wait for the result to come back.
Okay, guys, I think we need to move on to the next question from the audience. Apologies, by the way, for any background noise that you can hear. We are in a very busy conference center, so there are plenty of people outside and lots going on. So apologies for that. I hope it's not causing too much of a problem. I'm going to try and merge two questions, guys, so bear with me. Can you describe the difference between managed services and staff augmentation and also managed services between milestone contracts? So I'm not too sure about that second bit, so let's look at the first bit first. Can you describe the difference between managed services and staff augmentation? Anyone want to jump on that one?
I think managed services, you're taking your process and you're moving it over. They're basically managing it. You're buying it back as a service. If you're just doing staff augmentation, you remain responsible for the outcomes that you're looking to get, and you're just using their people to supplement your people. It's actually pretty simple. I mean, actually doing managed services is complex, but the concept's relatively easy. You're taking something that's an internal process, moving it outside, and you're buying it back.
Yeah. It ultimately comes down to who's accountable for the result.
It comes down to who's accountable for the result.
Yeah. Because not to reiterate, but with staff augmentation, I'm going to bring in people that are from a third party, but they're going to work under my direction. I am still responsible for the outcome, and I'm going to give them their direction on what to do and how to do it and so forth. With the managed service, I outsource the responsibility. I'm still ultimately accountable, but I can subrogate because I can say to them, you need to fix it. If you're just doing sample augmentation, they're doing what you told them to do.
You can also be a lot more creative with the way that you price out managed services because,
yes.
I mean, if you're just doing staff augmentation, it's always going to be FTE-based pricing, right? You're basically buying a person. When you're doing managed services, you're buying a process, and if they can make the process more efficient, you can decrease FTEs, you can drive costs out that way. So that's basically, I think, what the differences are.
What about milestone contracts? Apologies to whoever sent that in. It's not maybe the most coherent question, unfortunately. Where do milestone contracts fit in with managed services?
Milestone contracts, actually, that's a much better question than you might think it is, because this is a place where people get into a lot of trouble for absolutely no reason, except that they think that it sounds good to do these. So let's take the classic example of milestone-based contracting is transitions in outsourcing contracts, right? The riskiest thing that you can do in outsourcing is down selecting out the right partner. The next riskiest thing that you can do in an outsource is a blind hold the vendor to a time schedule, no matter what the cost, no matter what the result, milestone transition. Okay? And let me explain why. This is the way that this usually comes up. You have three different vendors. You're doing your outsourcing. You're going to get great, you know, cost savings because you're going to get all these economies to scale. You're going to get reduced rates. The chief financial officer looks at this and says, get this done quick, okay, because I want these cost savings. You turn around then and you start to compete these guys on time to transition because it's going to be on transition that you're going to start to get the cost savings theoretically. That's not really true, by the way. You're going to get the cost savings on transformation. Okay, but let's leave that question aside. So, although it's kind of important. So what do? You compete them on transition time. If vendor A basically tells you it's going to take them a year, vendor B tells you it's going to take them 3 months. Okay? Problem is that vendor A knows what they're doing and vendor B doesn't. Or they both know what they're doing and vendor B just wants to get the deal. Okay? So as a good lawyer and a good procurement organization and really tough negotiators, what do? You set up these milestones on transition. You don't pay them until they hit milestones, or you penalize them when they don't hit milestones. And that sounds good because you feel like you're protected. What you have just done is, and by the way, this could work, provided that you've done your own change readiness assessment and you can really change as fast as you're setting up those milestones. The problem is that most customers can't. Okay? So what they end up doing is they put their vendor in a situation where they have to behave in a way that absolutely kills their customer's organizational change management program, right? Then the transition fails. You're getting some penalties back from the vendor, but your transition's failed. Now that your transition's failed, what happens is that nobody else wants to adopt. Okay, whoever was the first one to transition blew it, and nobody else wants to transition, so it's a fight the whole rest of the way. You're going to have a multiplier effect on your entire BPO for the entire 5 years because you blew that transition. And it was done because it felt good, right? What you really need to do, and I'm not saying that you should never have milestone-based contracts, but you need to be aware of what your weaknesses are as a customer and your ability to basically receive the services that you're putting the vendor under such a tremendous amount of pressure to deliver. Because if you can't do your part, and if you've done your contract in a way so you can't breach it, which, by the way, a lot of good outsourcing lawyers will do it that way. I'll do it that way. That's great. You've won the contract, but you've lost the deal.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the thing about milestone contracts that you have to watch out for. It's a good question. And by the way, even if you only have one organization that's transitioning so you don't have the adoption problem, your vendor has probably, or the outsourcing program at that point, has blown its credibility to be able to get the transformation that you're looking for that's really going to drive the ROI.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so you've really blown a lot of things based on this one part. So I don't know if you guys want to.
Lots of agreement coming from over here.
Yeah, no, I think reflecting back to a prior career where I had the fortune to do and sort of, you know, be part on the vendor side and so the first one of industry or the first industry type outsourcing and the whole, you know, law enforcement response and massive sensor requests, and you got to process it. And so that was one of my social media clients outsourced. And at the same time, they were sort of outsourcing content, you know, moderation on their, you know, their social media site. At the same time, they were looking at outsourcing digital ads that you see, you know, from a B2B standpoint in your social network. And so neither the client organization, neither us as a vendor at the time, which was a leading global provider, had done that outsourcing. And so, you know, I think in that environment, you know, I kind of realized how some of the old models, such as, you know, milestone-based, don't work, because essentially they were like, you've got to co-locate with us in the same room, in the same office in Mountain View. There's no milestones. We're going to figure this out together. Mm-hmm. We don't know it, you don't know it, but we see the DNA of you being smart people. And then back to the first question, there wasn't, you know, it was still, you're ultimately responsible for this SLA or the outcome that, Tom, you were talking about, but you got a year to get there, right? Because we don't want to hold you accountable, mm-hmm. we don't know, but we're not measuring the process ourselves. And yes, we'll handpick the people, but we're going to not, it's not a fixed fee, but it's going to be basically based on, you know, a monthly rate per person, right? So it was a blending of a lot of different concepts we talked about, and I think that's where outsourcing is going, right? I mean, I think people have done third, fourth generation of M&A and IT, but the values in these newer areas of core industry processes and where I think some of the traditional models don't work as well.
Yep. Any thoughts you want to add on that, Tom?
Just what my colleague said.
Yeah, the only one caveat that I would add to that is that, you know, it would be nice if you could just put people in a room and have them figure things out. And I wasn't, by the way, suggesting that we completely abandon the idea of having some sort of milestones in some of these contracts, not because of holding people's feet to the fire and all that, but if you just think about this as an economic model for a second, part of economics is two things, right? It's not really about money. It's behavioral science, so you're trying to drive behaviors. But the other thing that economics is about is about allocating scarce resources. And you have to be careful not to be in a situation where you put your vendor in a position where they have scarce resources and it gets allocated to somebody else who is being a jerk, right?
Sure.
Because those scarce resources need to go over there to meet a milestone schedule and you don't have one, mm-hmm. right? So there is a little bit of that kind of tension too. So there's an art to this. And you have to know your vendor, you have to know your deal and what you're trying to achieve.
One complicating factor that I've seen, and really it's not just a milestone type contract, but contracts in general, is the incomplete baseline having been put in place by the buyer of what their internal costs and levers are for the process in question that's being outsourced. So then the supplier is bidding to something less than what they're actually going to be assumed to be held accountable for on the part of the supplier, because all of those costs have not been incorporated. So when you're putting down on a sheet of paper your evaluation matrix, you know, part of what you have to look at is what are going to be your retained costs, what are going to be the assumed costs on the part of the supplier, what are going to be your retained responsibilities and accountabilities, and what are going to be the assumed costs accountabilities on the part of the supplier. And also, are there any other additional costs that need to be accounted for? A lot of times I see this you know, in the software world where they'll talk about the cost of their software is cheap, but then when you start getting into the discussion around implementation, who's doing the implementation? Is it your internal team? Is it the supplier? Are you going to have to hire a third-party Big Four consulting firm to come in, and now you're adding another $1 million or $2 million on top of what you thought was a really good deal? You have to, again, go back to the holistic thinking, but you have to really make sure that all the costs and all the ownership and accountability and responsibilities are included, so that way, when you have that complete picture, when you're putting milestones out there, you're putting one out there based upon a complete understanding of the process and everyone's responsibilities in it. If you're trying to put milestones in place that are based on incomplete assumptions in the contract, you're destined to fail.
Clearly a topic that we could spend a lot more time on. We only have another 10 minutes though, so I think we need to move on. Gary, I think this is probably best directed to you to start off with. Does the CPO report in the right place? Most CPOs appear to report to the CFO. Shouldn't that change?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the underlying, you know, reason why that's the case is because the whole reason why the CPO role was constructed was, you know, the financial aspect, right? And what was the best place to sort of elevate procurement as a function that was sort of back office and sort of integrated a little bit higher was in the financial place. Now, I think now you're looking at a lot more financial and non-financial aspects, right? So there's supplier risk. Clearly,
their chief risk officers, right? Now you're looking at sustainability in your supply chain and supply chain risk, and clearly there's, you know, sustainability officers. So I think there's definitely room for CPOs, depending on the industry, to go beyond reporting to just the CFO. It could be in manufacturing environment to the COO. It could be a hybrid role of the chief procurement plus risk plus you know, sustainability, et cetera, type officer reporting to the CEO, depending on the industry. But I think clearly that's the way to go. And I think the way they'll get there is if they'll, you know, be bold and lead, be in front and center of these enterprise initiatives and not just stay in the comfort zone of managing spend.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on that, guys?
I don't have a problem with it reporting to the CFO. It could report to the COO if you want to take more of an operational approach to it. But I think the perspective should be more of not looking at it in terms of hard lines of reporting responsibility, but more like a Venn diagram, because to Gary's point, they have to interact with all these other different areas. If they're trying to do it in isolation, trying to, you know, manage it as, we are procurement, we own the world, and we'll tell you what we're going to buy, that's not going to work. They have to be that team player that's working with the business units to define those requirements and not get it into where it is a, you know, where you're trying to buy a commodity when you're really trying to buy something that has inherent value.
No, I mean, I agree with that. And as somebody who's sometimes subject to the procurement process, you know, a lot of times the procurement, so, and I had an article that came out one time. Somebody asked me if I thought that the advisory community was becoming obsolete. And I said no, because you can't lump the entire advisory community into one lump like that. What I get concerned about, and I'm not talking about lawyers now, I'm talking about really the advisors that help people do deals. Because a lot of times people are buying advisors now the way that they used to buy other category spends. So, you know, they compete them for costs, they compete them for results and that kind of stuff. And the issue I have with that is that a lot of times the people who are doing this don't understand how to buy the thing that the advisor is going to help them to buy.
Right.
And if they don't know how to do that, then how do you buy an advisor who's going to help you do that? You wouldn't understand what the value proposition is. So, you know, I think that gets back to what both you guys were saying, is that there needs to be more alignment with what the actual product is that's being bought.
Yeah, it's been a fairly common practice for the last 25 years. I'm sure it'll continue, regardless of what I'm about to say. But I see RFXs going out with frequency, and there is the thou shalt not clause, you know, stated in the first paragraph that you read, which says that, you know, we are the ones running this RFP process. You will not make any attempts to reach out to any business unit owners within the company. If you do, that's grounds for disqualification, blah, 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 blah. And yet the RFP comes out and it's relatively incomplete in terms of what we as a supplier would need to know to be able to provide a meaningful solution that's actually going to help you get to your goals. So if you're not going to let us talk to anybody in the business, how are we going to gain the insight to help you do that?
Well, yeah, the interesting thing there is that there's a tension between being the single point of contact and being able to control the process to a certain extent and actually getting information out.
Right.
And this is an easy problem to fix. That's the thing that's really funny about it. Is all that you have to do is a week after you have the RFP go out, to have some meetings, right? I don't know why people don't like talking to each other, but the more that people can talk to each other during these processes, the better it is. That doesn't mean that you unleash the vendor on the entire business and let them call whoever they want to. You get the right people at the table. Don't have to have the, you know, vendors do a bad proposal because they don't get the information. Let them look at the RFP for a couple of weeks. Have them come in and sit the business people down with them. Have the vendors one at a time, not as a group. Have them come in, ask the questions that they need to get clarification on before they submit a bad proposal.
Right.
It speeds up your process.
And again, don't presuppose you know what the solution is going to be. So when the supplier asks a question that may appear to be not in line with how you do things today, give them the answer based upon what you do know, because they may have in the back of their mind, based upon their experience, their client base, and so forth, a better approach based upon what your answer is going to be. So, you know, answer all questions. Don't be afraid. They're ultimately trying to help you.
Well, but the other thing there is you need to just create an environment where the vendor's not afraid.
Right.
Because lots of times the vendor's afraid to really probe the way that they need to probe because they don't know when they're going to be eliminated.
Right.
You need to set up sort of a safe zone. Right. You always have the opportunity to eliminate somebody who's you know, bad. But once you eliminate somebody who's good, you really messed yourself up, right? Because you're going to spend the rest of your entire relationship trying to power through a bad relationship with the wrong vendor with a contract, and that's the worst way to do it.
Again, we could carry on that topic, I think, for quite a while. We've got about 6 minutes left, and there's a question. I think this could probably take another webinar, frankly, but I'd really love to get your take on it. Does RPA mean the age of labor arbitrage is dead? And if so, have the Indian majors done enough to stay relevant in the new landscape? Anyone want to pick that up?
I don't think labor arbitrage in and of itself is dead. It may be impacted by RPA, clearly. But in the case of India, that was cited, their costs have been going up on the people side for the last 15 years. So. And that was before the introduction of RPA. I remember when I was the first Indian company that I worked for back in the early 2000s, they were seeing offers being extended by competing firms. You know, leave there if you're a manager or above and come to our firm and we'll pay you 40% more. Well, you can only do that so long before your prices start looking like the clients that were looking for the labor arbitrage in the first place. So. That's just a natural supply and demand kind of thing, because even in India, after they initially launched and they have all the great smart people in the major cities, then they had to go to the secondary cities, then they're having to go down to the tertiary cities, and then they even had to then look out and go to other geographies to find cheaper labor, still intelligent people, but you know, the labor arbitrage will exist somewhere in some way, shape, or form.
Either of you guys want to pick up on that?
Yeah, no, I think I agree with Tom. I think what I do foresee, I think there will always be arbitrage because there will always be places that are cheaper. This whole urban rural sourcing is a big trend, you know, even in India now and in the Philippines. But I think the labor component of an outsourcing deal may become less important relative to the transformational than the automation component.
Yeah, and there's a lot of issues ultimately when you're looking at particularly offshore that need to be factored in. You mentioned these earlier. If you take the Philippines as an example, the Philippines is a destination on a price per person is higher or has historically been higher than was the case in India. But yet the Philippines rose to be the number one BPO destination despite the higher cost. Now, there are other factors that led to that, cultural alignment, political stability, and so forth, that were not the case in some other geographies. Well, that's that map is always going to be changing. So you got to be looking at a whole matrix of site location type questions to help determine where you want your business to be done, and short term and long term, looking at the government impacts, the environmental impacts, the technological impacts, the societal impacts, that's going to be a changing landscape. So I think if you factor all of those things in, the labor arbitrage is one component of it. But if your risk is high, even though the cost is low, now you have a risk management question that you have to deal with. Is it worth the lower price?
Ed, any thoughts on that?
No, I think this is pretty well covered. There are more interesting questions about RPA and labor than I think the arbitrage question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are you going to wind up in a situation at some point where you're basically losing basic skill sets?
Mm-hmm.
And things like that, but that's not really labor arbitrage. That gets into a different question.
Well, that came up in the session that I chaired yesterday, actually. You know, when I think one of the guys in the audience was gonna lose 60% of his staff within 5 years from retirement, and one of the options was to augment the staff with RPA at a much lower rate, much lower cost. But his problem was, actually, I want to bring in new knowledge. I want to, I want to keep the knowledge within the organization. I want to develop skills, and I want to kind of drive innovation through the acquisition of new talent. And that's something I'm not going to get if I simply kind of robotize rather than bring in new people, which I thought was quite an interesting take on it. We've got about a minute left, guys, so I would suggest we can't really take any more questions. Any final thoughts from you guys on some of the things that have come out today? Any kind of sound bites you want to throw our attendees before we close down?
I think it's an exciting time to be in procurement and in outsourcing, and I think a lot of change in the environment and technology and new sources of value, and I think procurement just needs to be bold and really take the new sources of value by the heart.
Thank you, Gary. Anything from you, Ed?
Actually, it was just a treat to be able to participate in this today. You know, as a lawyer lots of times the question is, what's the term that you put into a contract to do this? And it's just a lot of fun to get the opportunity to talk with you know, people about this kind of thing and these kinds of changes on a different level and just like what's the tactical thing you do? What's, you know, getting into some of the strategic issues is just a lot of fun. So I just want you to, I just really appreciated this and really enjoyed this.
Well, the privilege and honor was all ours. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure to have you. Tom, any closing thoughts before you?
No, I'll echo what my colleagues have said and you know, appreciate the opportunity to participate today. Hopefully I'll have the opportunity to participate in the future. Obviously I'll be continuing to write articles and do additional work for Outsource Magazine. And the Sourcing Angels Group has been a great organization. This is probably my 40th event with them that I've gone to. I was at the first one 25 years ago. You know, the best way to learn is learning from your peers. So get out there and network.
Great, thank you very much. Apologies to those of you whose questions we didn't get to cover. Of course, the email addresses of our panelists are on screen and have been during the one-to-ones as well. My email address is not up there at the moment, but if you have any questions about this Outsource Talks or anything else to do with Outsource or indeed Sourcing Industry Group, then you can email me at jliddell@sig.org. We're going to be here for the remainder of the SIG Summit in the next couple of days. Please do check out the hashtag SIGFall16 for all the tweets coming out of this summit. And we will see you at the next Outsource Talks on November the 16th. The final one this year will be on December 21st. It's always the third Wednesday of every month, guys. And next year, we're going to be doubling up, doing two a month. So it'll be twice as much amazing thought leadership coming out to you guys from Outsource Talks. Thank you very much to my panel. It's been fantastic to have you here, guys. Really great chat, and thank you very much for attending. Take care. Bye.